The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome to this special video game edition of the Tech Weekly podcast with me, Guardian games writer Jordan Erica Weber.
And me, the Guardian's games editor Keith Stewart. It's autumn now, which means the nights are drawing in and the leaves are falling off the trees. But gamers won't notice any of these ephemeral things because this is the season in which the shops are full of blockbuster video games, all of which are flung onto the market at exactly the same time in order to snare those all-important Christmas sales.
So imagine the season's video game release lineup as a family tin of Quality Street. With our panel of experts, we're going to separate the delicious walnut whirls from the repulsive strawberry creams.
But we'll also be asking an increasingly pressing question. Is there really enough variety and diversity for a medium that claims to be the biggest and richest on the planet? Can big publishers really sustain the hugely expensive AAA release model into the next decade?
First, here are today's guests. I'm going to get everyone to introduce themselves. Holly, let's start with you.
Hi, I'm Holly Pickering and I'm an independent game developer.
Hello, I'm Keza McDonald. I am the editor of a games website called Kotaku UK.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Lovell. I run a website on the business of games called Games Brief. I help a number of companies make more money from video games. And I wrote a book last year called The Curve, which is about how you make money when everything is going free.
So this is the part of the year that every games writer either loves or dreads. From September 1st, we're officially in holiday season, and the release schedule is just as stuffed as the Christmas turkey.
This year, things have got off to a very strong start with Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain. But on the way, we also have post-apocalyptic adventures with Fallout 4, sneaky assassination with Assassin's Creed Syndicate, and a whole host of music games, shooters, and toy-to-life titles. So, panel, what out of that smorgasbord, that Christmas cracker of releases, are people looking forward to? Keza, let's start with you. What are you looking forward to?
I am greatly looking forward to the return of the music game, which is one of my specialties in life, and it's been completely useless for the last 5 years because everyone stopped making them.
That's it, yeah, because obviously games like Rock Band and Guitar Hero, right? They were huge.
Enormous.
Up until 2010, wasn't it?
2010 exactly was the last game in that genre that got released, because basically they kept releasing plastic instruments every year and nobody wanted to buy 40 plastic guitars with little colourful buttons.
And you had to have like a PhD in video game peripherals to work out which guitars were compatible with which games.
It was insane. Yeah. Still going to be a bit of a problem. In the next few months, we have new Guitar Hero, which is called Guitar Hero Live,
yep.
Which has one guitar, very simple, just a guitar. And originally that guitar was going to be compatible with everything from your phone to your games console to whatever, but unfortunately not anymore. And then you have Rock Band, which is a whole band setup. So you have plastic drums, plastic guitar, plastic bass, and someone singing, which was the source of many of my best times ever at university. So I get to relive those heady days of 2005-ish.
For only £220, you can replace them all now.
£220 is an insane amount of money to pay for a video game, but I did look up, and apparently it's...
Is that... What's £220?
The Rock Band kit.
The full kit.
£220 of your pounds.
Otherwise known as how much it costs to get Skylanders.
You could buy a wedding band for that and just have them play for you.
It's completely in line with inflation. It's the same price as the £170 original Rock Band was in 2005, which I was very surprised to learn, and just made me think about how little everyone's salary has gone up in that time.
The famous Rock Band metric,
yes,
of salaries.
Exactly.
But what's different? Because I know with Guitar Hero Live, they've completely rethought the guitar and changed it. So it isn't five coloured buttons anymore. They've basically got two rows of four buttons because they found that everybody had a real problem with that fifth button.
They've got three rows of two buttons.
Three rows,
yes.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, it depends which way you've got the guitar around.
I suppose, yes. But yeah, it's you only need three fingers, but you move. It feels more like playing chords on a real guitar.
Yeah, which is what they aim to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's not any. I've been playing with it quite a lot lately because, again, obsessive, and it's not particularly more difficult. than before, or easier, but it's a different kind of skill. So if you were like me and you played Guitar Hero for thousands of hours, to the extent that if you'd spent those hours on a real instrument, you'd probably be playing Wembley by now. If you're like me, then it's the new Guitar Hero is great because it's got a new mechanic, it's got a new fun thing to get your head around and get your fingers around. New Rock Band is going the other way, and it's being exactly the same as it was in 2010, with no change at all to how anything is done, just a better kind of online song catalogue. Whereas Guitar Hero Live's got basically like an MTV thing constantly running. It's got this called Guitar Hero TV, so you can drop in at any time and there's music videos playing with the tracks and you can just play along with whatever's going on, so it's more like a kind of Spotify vibe.
Yeah, like music videos other people have recorded, like in Dance Central.
No, they are the real music videos.
The real music videos. So it's like watching MTV, but suddenly being able to butt in and play along with it.
Just play along the solo. Play the solo. It's good. Yeah. It's fun. I think it's good. Although the difference being, Rock Band is more old school. Guitar Hero Live is a new take on the genre. So I think there's something for everyone there.
Okay, so we're kind of looking forward to those then. That's good. Holly, what are there any big AAA games that you're looking forward to?
Not so much, but I am kind of interested in Tony Hawk Pro Skater 5.
That's really funny, because of all the ones on the list, I looked at that and was like, no one's going to care about that one.
It's because skateboarding games haven't really been done, and then I guess they've had a resurgence, what with Ollie Ollie, and that's
which is a lovely popular indie 2D skating game.
Yeah.
Made in Britain. Really excellent.
Yeah, made by my boyfriend.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see what's going on here.
I didn't know whether we were
going to
say that.
Right.
So there's that, I suppose. So that I'm looking forward to. I'm not massively keen on the art style. So I guess we'll kind of just have to see how that plays. That'll be a feel thing for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think as well, Tony Hawk's, at least in the kind of PlayStation and PlayStation 2 genre, was like the kind of Rock Band of its era, and it was really social, wasn't it? Like, Tony Hawk's was one of the... And it had a really kind of nice freestyle feel about it, didn't it? So when you could get home from the pub and you could challenge each other to see who can get the most points, and you really got a sense of the environment.
Yeah, home from school,
Also, it had a plastic peripheral with Tony Hawk's Ride,
which is what killed
because
Tony Hawk's is another series which was massively overexploited. So I mean, it looks interesting, but I mean, it's not getting great feedback from people that have played
that's
so
the kind of the problem. So that's kind of what I was saying, like, I think that'll be a feel thing, because I don't think visually it's that exciting at the moment.
Nicholas, what are you looking forward to?
So I'm challenged in some ways what I'm looking forward to, because I keep looking forward to my Steam Library of Shame.
Right. Oh, you've got one of those.
So many games in there that I haven't played yet that I really want to. I'm behind on Dragon Age. I'm behind on so many games. But the games I am looking forward to, well, I want to be looking forward to Fallout 4. I tried getting into Fallout 3, and after the first 45 minutes of tortuous intro, and I'm now a bit trained into the world of free-to-play games, which, like TV shows, they just get you into the action quickly, because if they don't, then you're not sticking around. And while I really wanted to like Fallout 3, it spent 45 minutes going, I don't care about your time. I really don't care about your time. I'm going to do this really slow stuff with no mechanics, trying to make you care. And by the time I actually got into the game, which was a genre I love, RPGs, I just went, I'd hate you. I hate you. And I played it for 3 hours and I never got back from the hating. So I really want to like Fallout 4.
Yeah.
But I fear that though I'm very happy to spend lots of time on games, I'm 300 hours into FTL, I can get committed to a game. It has to be something that starts showing me the mechanics and fun early. And I'm not sure that Fallout 4 is going to do that.
So what you're saying is it's got to be love at first sight. You might stay with them forever, but it's got to be love at first sight.
You're saying the game's got to put out.
That's what I'm trying to say.
This is a problem across games at the moment, though. I feel like games have less and less respect for your time. It's very much like, here is a game, that'll be 80 hours of your time, please. You know, and I think that this is partly to do with this perception of value. You know, people who spend, the people who spend £50 on a game, the perception is that they want value for their money. But I think, like a lot of us now, we don't have that kind of time to spend on everything. And especially this year, there's been, I counted 12 huge, like 60, 70 plus hour games that have gotten amazing, you know, amazing critical reception, and that many people who are into games would like to play. And I think it's, unless you're a student, it's literally impossible to actually play all of them. So I mean, more respectful of our time.
Do you think this is, you said there was 12 there, and I'm wondering, is that disproportionate to the other years, or whether that's something that you're just, because I mean, all of us around this table aren't in our, well, I don't know, I can't speak for Holly, or we're not in our early 20s anymore. So, I mean, when I was in my early 20s, when working for Edge magazine, I would quite happily play a game for a whole weekend. I would put,
But even a weekend's not enough now.
No.
You used to be able to finish a game, most games, in 20 to 30 hours, you'd be done. like almost all games. You know, and very occasionally you get this enormous open world one that would be like 50 hours plus, whereas now, this year we've had 7 enormous open world games, plus things like Destiny, new updates to GTA Online, other things that are just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours, and you can never really be done with them, you just have to decide to stop.
The thing is, aren't these games aimed at people who only buy one or two games a year? And then you have the mobile games that take up the rest of your time. Like, we're just looking at it like that because we're game journalists who are expected to play everything.
I wrote about this last week, and the overwhelming reception from that, from everybody was, yeah, actually, the games don't respect my time. Like, I'm not asking, is it worth my money? I'm asking, is it worth my time? So I'd rather have something that I feel like I can get the most out of in 20 to 30 hours than, you know, this volume of enormous games. Because a lot of it's padding. A lot of the stuff that's actually in the you know, the experience, the 60 of those 100 hours are probably take or leave things.
Yeah. I mean, Nicholas, do you think this has become part of the business model now? In that, do you think that publishers believe that people are only going to buy 2 or 3 of these big AAA titles, and therefore they're creating these kind of enormous events around them?
And certainly, I think the big events is true. I think we're seeing the industry shift into at least 2 modes and possibly 3. We have the big blockbusters, which are a bit like movies, except you can watch a movie in 2 hours. Mm. Whereas to watch a blockbuster, to experience a blockbuster game, you're committing a minimum of 20 hours and then you've only scratched the surface of it. So a serious movie buff can watch every single major movie in a year without that much trouble. I mean, you do it professionally as journalists, it's pretty hard to experience all of the games you ought to play at a proper level in a year. Yes, exactly. So there's that direction. So they're sort of thinking we're like movies, but a game like Grand Theft Auto last year, a game like, well, any of these ones we're naming, Fallout or Metal Gear Solid or whatever, there's a huge experience in there. It's really tough to stay involved. Then we've got the ones which feel a lot more like TV. They're generally free to play, but that can cover everything from League of Legends, where 27 million people play a League of Legends match every single day. Enormous number of people who, if you're playing it, have to be hugely committed. They're absolutely up at the 100 plus hours. I mean, way more than that in terms of playing the game. And I think there's a danger that people making blockbuster experiences that Keza was talking about are looking at these games that people want to play every day and think they have to compete directly. But those games make more money the more people play them, and the blockbuster games don't make more money the more often people play them. The more they need to sell more units, they don't need to have people in the game for more hours. And I think there's a danger, there's a mismatch, that people are looking at what people are doing in one type of game, and from my point of view, one type of business model, and applying another one.
Yeah, I mean, but there's something to be said, like Fallout 4, for example. I know that I'm not going to see everything in Fallout 4, and we should probably explain. Fallout 4 is a kind of post-apocalyptic role-playing adventure in which you're thrust into a future version of America that's been devastated by a nuclear conflict about 200 years ago. It's very very open. You get to interact with lots of tribes. You get to build for yourself a kind of your own settlement and really create this kind of world around you. What I find as a gamer is that there's enough in there for me just to sort of fiddle around in the world, just do what I want to do. Like in Witcher 3, I just did loads of side missions and I got like 20 hours of fun out of it. And I'm never going to ever get anywhere near finishing it. So maybe we as gamers have to shift our priorities and think of games almost as tourism, where we're in an environment and we're not going to be able to do everything. It's like maybe playing Witcher 3 is kind of like going to New York for the weekend, in that there's a few things you want to do and you're happy that you've done the things that you have. Does that make sense?
I think the best thing about video games as compared to books and movies is there's no set way that they have to be. Movies are all about the same length. But with video games, you've got some that are really, really short that you can play every day. And then you've got some that if you choose to, you can spend hours and hours in and just buy one game and play that all year.
I think this also speaks to the rise of Twitch and Let's Play. People who go, if I want to watch the end of this interactive experience, I have to get properly good at it. I have to learn how to play it. Or I can sit there over my Weetabix in the morning watching somebody who's put all of the 100 hours in, and I just get to watch the end on a video. Maybe I'll just do that. And on the one hand, I think the rise of Twitch is awesome. It means that you get this new distribution channel, this new way of people experiencing games. On the other hand, it's people watching other people play our medium because we've made our medium too hard and too demanding for a bunch of people to play, which does make me wonder if at some direction we're getting it wrong.
Sorry, Keza, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that the thing about Twitch that I don't understand is, how do you find time to watch other people play games on top of trying to play
these
games?
Nobody just watches Twitch.
It's just impossible.
Everybody has it on in the background.
Yeah, mm. I think it's one of those, it's become wallpaper for me all the time, Twitch. But yeah, I think that when I was growing up, it was possible, and indeed not even that hard, to play every worthwhile game in a year, in a given year. You know, most games, you could play all of them. All of the worthwhile ones that were going to give you some kind of intellectual satisfaction or other satisfaction or fun, you could play all of them in a year. And I think we've just all got to accept that that's not the case anymore, and probably hasn't, well, I know it hasn't been for at least the last 3 or 4 years. And going forward, like, you're probably just not going to be able to completely play every interesting game in a year. And so most people who play games now, as the audience expands and expands, a lot of those new people who are coming in are folk who, they play hundreds of hours of video games a year, but they play one or two games. They don't play,
sure.
They're not generalists. Yeah. Like, a lot of us growing up with games were generalists, you know?
Yeah, it comes side by side with industry growth, right? Which I'm sure Nicholas has a lot to say about.
So I think the good news is that we've got some amazing high-quality games with very high budgets coming out into the marketplace. The bad news for some of the companies involved is that there's not actual evidence that that market is growing, but there is clear evidence the budgets are growing, and that combination is very, very dangerous.
We'll hopefully get onto that in a second. That's all right, that's fine. One thing I was going to mention was there are some interesting shooters, which are the games I tend to play, which was Star Wars Battlefront, which is EA DICE, the creators of the Battlefield series, have their Star Wars online multiplayer Star Wars game where you get to indulge in Empire versus Rebel shootouts on Hoth and other famous Star Wars landscapes. And I saw this at E3 and I was kind of quite skeptical about it. And I thought it was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. It had a beautiful kind of understanding of the dynamics of the Star Wars universe. It used all the recognizable special effects. It just, like, being a kid who, and this is such an obvious thing to say, but being a kid who grew up watching those films, and I went to see Empire Strikes Back about 5 times at the cinema, to be able to, like, feel a part of that experience was just kind of wonderful. It was brilliant. So that was good. Even though it is basically an online shooter and the same thing we've been doing for years, what EA DICE have done is perfectly captured the fantasy of being in that environment. I also played the Black Ops 3, Call of Duty Black Ops 3 multiplayer beta. And that, again, is the developer Treyarch, who've done all the Black Ops series and worked on Call of Duty World at War as well. Black Ops 2 was the most successful, one of the most successful games ever made, and certainly the most successful Call of Duty made. And I think Black Ops 3 is really, really interesting what it's done with multiplayer. It hasn't, like, massively radicalized it, but the sense of movement in it, the way you progress, the environments, the little additions, like the ability now to swim underwater and shoot people from underwater, which is quite cool. Those sort of things, like micro changes to the environment, but quite nice. So those are two games I'm kind of looking forward to, even though they're very mainstream. So, last week in The Guardian, I ran a feature by an anonymous games developer who works in the industry, and they were saying in this article that they didn't feel that in AAA game development there was enough variety and creativity to sustain a career for someone who wants to explore different ideas. They were saying that the video game industry has kind of homogenized around a certain number of, very small number of genres, and lots of that kind of quirks of games design seems to have been ironed out in the AAA sort of sector. The developer mentioned Resident Evil, which in the early days of the Resident Evil series, the survival horror series, the games were really tense, really exciting, very little ammunition, whereas now most horror games are about taking a machine gun, blowing away as many zombies as you possibly can. The developers kind of saw this as symbolic of an industry that was moving towards this idea that all games have to be a kind of epic, seamless, intuitive experience with those kind of wrinkles ironed out. So, is there enough creative diversity within the mainstream video games industry?
I think that there is great diversity even in the upper echelons of video game development. You just have to go looking for it. If you are only ever looking at what's on the shelf at Game, then that's equivalent to only ever looking at what's in the in-flight movies. You know, you're only ever going to get a certain type of film, and you're only ever going to get the biggest stuff with the most marketing shoved into your face. So one game that is put out by Square Enix, which is an enormous publisher who's also doing lots of other, you know, more conventional games this year, is Life is Strange, which is an episodic game about, it's essentially about growing up. It's about a teenage girl in a kind of American small town setting. And she discovers that she has the ability to rewind time. So the game ends up being, instead of like a sci-fi or rewind time, you know, thing, it ends up being more about the decisions that you make in adolescence and how much you would give to be able to take them back. and also the things that are in your control and out of your control in your personal relationships at that time. And it's a wonderful game that I think is going to be one of the best of the year. It's still to conclude. It concludes in October. The last episode comes out. But that's a game that's been put out into this space by the same developer that does Hitman, the same developer that does Tomb Raider. So I think it is there. It's just that if you're only ever looking at what's put in front of you, then you're not going to see the diversity.
Yeah.
It's the same publisher, though. So, I mean, it's great that they put money into that. And, you know, a lot of credit goes to Don't Nod for coming up with that. Yeah, like, because that's an incredible game and on my list of things I'm really looking forward to this season.
But that does seem to be one thing that publishers are doing more of. Ubisoft is like a good example of a company that will put time and effort, or at least some money, small budgets, into their studios making more experimental titles. You know, the obvious examples being, is it Valiant Hearts?
Child of Light.
Mm. Yeah, and Grow Home as well. Yeah.
Grow Home's amazing.
Yeah, which are all really good games, aren't they?
Well, that illustrates that Ubisoft's a company that does Assassin's Creed and Grow Home. I think that this is happening now. It's not just that certain companies make enormous big blockbusters and certain companies make cool, fun indie stuff. I think that there's actually a lot more diversity in the output of even the biggest publishers and the most predictable ones, you might think. There's a lot more diversity than sometimes we remember to appreciate.
At the heart of it, people making video games want to make interesting video games. So even if they end up working for AAA companies, they're making these huge games, they will want to use some of the money they make to make smaller projects as well.
I do wonder as well whether, I mean, this doesn't help. The developer was saying they were thinking of their career and thinking, I want to work on interesting games and those aren't available. But I think for gamers, it's almost like the onus of doing interesting things is kind of more on us now. Because if you think about a game like Grand Theft Auto or Witcher or Metal Gear Solid, where people are finding their own things to do within the game environment. And these aren't always things which have been created by the, or even meant by the developer. It's things that people are just messing around with, like setting up great big car stunts in Grand Theft Auto 5, or just photographing the amazing environments in Metal Gear. So I'm just wondering if, like, maybe what developers are doing now are creating environments to play in, and we have to construct that variety rather than relying on it being fed to us.
That is kind of the entire coverage remit of my website. a lot of games journalism over the years has been mostly, here's a product that is happening, let us tell you about this product. And that's become, apart from being not particularly interesting now, it's also, that's a job that the people who are making the games are doing for themselves now. You know, Twitter has happened. They have their own drip feed of marketing information. So instead of being the gatekeepers to information about games, what we like to do on Kotaku is to look for these stories about gamers and about what they're doing with the games. Like, we all know Metal Gear Solid is out. We all know it's really good. So what about this particular guy who's convinced that there's an impossible secret ending and he's been spending the last 3 weeks coordinating a team of 20 people trying to find it? That's a more interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was going to say the conspiracy theorists in Grand Theft Auto 5 that believe there's, you know, a UFO hidden under one of the mountains and things like that. Yeah,
I think there is still a commercial challenge here, which is that your anonymous developer was, I imagine, complaining that when we try to pitch new ideas to a green light committee, the committee that sits at the centre of a publisher saying, can I sell this? They sit there and they look at things like the genre and they look at the competitors. And for a long time, it's been, that's a popular genre, let's jump on the bandwagon. And we've seen a bunch of MOBAs, the League of Legends competitors, coming out and being canned because those are online service-based games. But the previous business model was just, we need to make something a bit like that, but a fraction different. And part of that reason was because the idea was that gamers always want something new. They'll get bored with last year's hit. We can just reskin it and make this year's hit. And as Kez has said already, that's happening less and less. People are spending more time with existing games trying to find new angles. And at least for some of us in this room, there are too many games for us to play anyway. So simply, I'll buy it because it's new, is getting harder and harder.
Yeah. And also, and one thing I did want to talk about very quickly was, there's been rumours that Metal Gear Solid 5, which is one of the most looked forward to games of this year and will be considered one of the successes, cost over $80 million to make. And people are saying, well, it's going to need, you know, it sold 3 million copies in a week, which is great, but it's going to need to pass, you know, 5 to 6 million copies in order to sort of start breaking even. If this is one of the most exciting releases of the year, what does this mean for the games industry? Because what we're seeing now is average development costs going up. I mean, in the last generation, it was around $30 million for a AAA game. This year, it could be anything up to $60 million because the PS4 and Xbox One are exponentially more powerful, therefore you need more art assets, you need bigger teams, you also have downloadable content, server infrastructures to maintain, but the price, the retail price of the games is fixed. So Absolutely. Are we actually heading towards this kind of tipping point where it's actually economically, financially yes. unviable?
It's even worse than you mentioned, because you're talking about development budget, but the development budget can be as little as 25% of the final cover price once you've taken in the retailer's share. Obviously, the marketing budget, which is frequently the same size as the dev budget. So that's optional. But if you spend $80 million on the dev of the game, the rule of thumb might be $80 million on marketing. I think they might not do that for that title because the $80 million is just too high. But yeah, we talked $250 million was the estimated budget. Sorry, $265 million was the estimated budget for Grand Theft Auto V, including marketing and the manufacturing cost of millions of discs. Sure, that game made $1 billion in 3 days at retail. So it works. I think we're seeing inevitably fewer studios will be able to afford to play in this space, which I think is bad for the diversity of output of any form. Nearly all of the creative media, book publishing, record labels, movies, consolidate to 5 or 6 large studios as the only people who can handle the investment in these high-risk, high-return environments. We've still got more than 5 studios or publishers out there. Leaving aside the platform holders, if there's 5 slots at the top table, I think Konami's just bowed out. So we've got EA and Activision, who I think are there, and there's 3 slots left, and the other people are going to go bust. Even if we think that the Ubisoft is doing great things with a variety of titles, you've just got fewer people greenlighting projects. You've got less money to go around. You have the danger of more risk averseness. And on top of that, the number of people buying games, buying AAA console games, isn't going up. And very slowly, they're being nibbled away at the edges, whether or not it's by Candy Crush or by League of Legends and all the other titles around there. I think it's a difficult time to see lots of new publishers emerging prepared to take big creative risks.
If you're a developer working on a mobile app or website and you're searching for a simple payment solution, look no further than Braintree V.0. This snippet of code allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more from customers around the world, all with a single integration. For more information and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly now.
All right, let's leave the tinsel-laden AAA market behind and wander into the delightful indie gaming grotto. What can we expect from smaller teams this winter? Holly.
As you said before, I'm really looking forward to the last episode of Life is Strange. October 20th is the release date, so everyone write it down. There is also a point-and-click adventure game I'm quite interested in called Read Only Memories, which is by Midboss, which is a team brought together by the people who founded GamerX, and which is like a LGBTQ game expo event thing in the States, which is it's kind of like an old school inspired point-and-click adventure game. We've also got The Flame in the Flood, which I think should be out by the time this podcast goes out. And that's a really, really beautiful rogue light. And I think those people, like, I think the art director used to work at Irrational. And it's just...
Irrational is the big studio behind
BioShock. Behind BioShock. Yeah. And it's basically, you know, foraging, crafting. And you have a little dog companion as well who has a little backpack. So
is it optional? I don't like dogs. I'm worried about this in Fallout 4.
I love dogs. I have a problem when I see a dog on the street and I just go, oh, dog face. And I just go a bit.
Do you feel like you have to buy a game if it has a dog in it? For any marketers who are listening.
You know what? I think there's an update to the time-honored Kesa McDonald horse metric, which is that if a game has a horse, it is statistically more likely to be really good. Like, think about it. You got Red Dead Redemption, Ocarina of Time, Metal Gear Solid 5, a lot Oblivion. Of games with horses.
Minecraft.
Really, Minecraft. A lot of games with horses. Really, really good. Witcher 3. So I think the dog metric perhaps might be coming into play. Like, if a game has a dog.
That sounds like it's a thing.
Call of Duty. Yeah.
Extra points on Metacritic if it's got a dog.
Yeah. No. I have one last one as well, which is Mushroom 11.
No, that's mine!
fine.
Okay, I'm not going to mention it then. You can say it.
It's my only indie
Quick,
game.
Quick, Jordan, get in with Mushroom 11.
Yeah,
what
so Mushroom 11. I can't even remember who's developing it, but it's Untamed. A puzzle. Untamed Games is developing it. I think they're a husband and wife team. Two husbands and two wives.
Yeah.
It's a puzzle platformer in which you play kind of a fungus. The way you move it is you delete bits of it, and then the physics kind of make it acts like a solid object, but it looks like it's flowing like a liquid. So you delete bits of it, and then it kind of falls over, and then you keep deleting, and it kind of rolls, and it grows back in the opposite direction. And it's just so unlike anything I've seen, which is becoming a rarity in puzzle platformers. I'm a big fan of the genre, but developers, I think, are finding it more difficult to come up with new conceits for their games. And Mushroom 11 is definitely very unique, and I'm a really, really beautiful.
Keza. Indie games.
So the way it tends to work with me in indie games is I find out about them once they're out, because it's already too hard to keep on track to keep track of all the enormous games. But there is, I'm going to call it an indie game, that's coming out technically in January, but December if you backed it on Kickstarter, which is Amplitude by Harmonix. Amplitude was my favourite game when I was about 14, and it is a rhythm action game. It was the game that introduced me to music games, one of my great passions. And it is like a club fever dream, essentially, where the music's all techno / electronic music, and you are a little ship and you've got to blast notes in time with the music, and it's extremely synesthetic, this game. Like, it transports you into this state of, like, it does things like the patterns that it makes, like it does things like expanding hexagons and tunnels, and it's the same patterns that your brain makes on its own when left alone or given a bit of chemical assistance. So the way that the game works is it induces this kind of synesthetic state and a kind of sense of zone and kind of oneness that is amazing. And it's also just a really fun, mechanically really fun rhythm game, really fun music game. And I am so excited about it coming out. I gave them so much money on the Kickstarter. I spent all my money on it. And I can't wait for it to turn up, because it's one of those games that I thought would never happen. You know, a sequel to this beloved game of my teenage years. And I think it's going to be rocking.
Nicholas, from the indie sector, what do you...
The game I want to play, unfortunately, is already out. I'm in the same place as Keza. It's a game called Big Pharma, which is kind of...
Oh, yes. Which is PHARMA.
Yes, it's not about farms, it's about pharmaceuticals and not chemical assistance to your brain for synesthesia types. It's basically a game, it's a tycoon game about running a major pharmaceutical business made by an indie team in the UK called Twice Circled. And it's just a title it's the type of genre I like, tycoon games, and I just haven't got round to it. So is it in my Steam? I don't think it's in my Steam library yet, so it's not yet in my Hall of Shame. It's just a title which I really want to get.
Okay, so I'm going to finish with a couple of indie games that I'm really looking forward to. Super Hot by the Super Hot team, a Polish a kind of weird first-person shooter in which the bullets coming towards you only move when you do. So it's actually more of a kind of a spatial puzzler in which you have to work your way through corridors of bullets by only moving in specific places. It's very visually very brash and bright. Very interesting. I think that's going to be very exciting, and that's coming out later this year. Along the same lines as Big Pharma is Prison Architect, but from Introversion, which has been in early access on PC for a long time. But this is a game in which you have to build a prison to adequately home a large number of dangerous criminals, and then you have to sort of work out how safe and you make it compared to how much it costs you to make. It's really, really interesting, intricate kind of ant farm style game, except the ants are violent homicidal maniacs. Finally, it's just come out. I would say a game you've really got to play. It's very different from anything else that we've talked about, is Rinse and Repeat by Robert Yang, which is a game in which you have to scrub a hunky guy clean in the shower. You will not have played anything like that much if you've stuck
Speak
to AAA
for yourself.
Games. Well, yeah, not. I don't mean in real life.
Oh, right,
in
sure.
digital form. Could we've all cleaned hunky men in the shower in real life, Jordan.
Also, speaking of showering with hunky men, shower with your dad simulator.
Yes, it's a whole new genre now. Yeah,
it's a thing. Shower with your dad simulator, I thought was a joke, but it's a real game thing. With a really weirdly well-produced trailer that does a whole, like, a spoof version of Kanye West's Power about showers.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. I am Keith Stewart.
And I'm Jordan Erica Webber.
Our producer today, our very patient producer, has been Jason Phipps. And thank you very much to our guests, Nicholas, Keza, and Holly.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.